done some programs on super fires, and other people call them mega fires, but until now, there really hasn't been a standard of what that means. What does your paper suggest as a good name and then as a measurement?
Well, that's right. We, in the fire science community, have been using the word megafire, but there's been some discomfiture about the use of the word because it's very difficult to define. Is it a very intense fire? Is it a very big fire? Is it a very destructive fire? Is it a very historically anomalous fire? There are lots of ways a fire could be really big, a megafire. What we did was two things. Firstly, we settled on the idea of energy as being a good index of fire, an extreme fire, and we avoided in our paper the use of the word megafire because it's an ambiguous term, and also the way we calculated these extreme fire events, we're not able to necessarily say it is a single fire. Because as you know, during these extreme fire events, you may have several fire fronts, and firefighters may call each one of those fire fronts a separate name, as now it's becoming the custom that we generally name major fires. And so you could have several fires burning in a region, each one almost with its own individual character. And what we did was put a lattice down across the world, a 10 by 10 kilometre lattice, and then we looked at the energy of the hotspots detected by the MODIS satellite. The whole basis of the paper and our database was to say, well, if you sum all of those hotspots in a small area, that's a fire event. And then if you rank all of the fires we could observe in a 12-year period, some 23 million. And then what we did is we chopped off the top 500 and said, well, in anybody's language, the top 500 out of 23 million have got to be extreme. And then we studied those fires in detail to develop, I guess, a sample of extreme fires. Now, had we had more time, it's extremely time-consuming to attribute all of those 500 fires because we don't have a international database on fires. If we had an international database on fires, our paper would have been entirely redundant. We would have just, somebody would have already analysed that database, but it doesn't exist. There's no national, internationally agreed, and in many cases, no nationally agreed fire records. Some countries have better fire records than others. And what we were hungering for was an international perspective, because as many of your listeners would know, if you're interested in the environment, over the last 10 or 15 years, we're having reports of unusual fires, fires in Israel. And you go, that's odd, I didn't know they had forest fires in Israel, or fires in Greece, or fires in France, or fires in Chile, or fires in Australia, which I guess people know, but then extremely crazy fires in Australia, and then lots of them. So you need a global perspective to make sense of what's going on, and that's what our study did. And we used the index of intensity, and we looked at the most extreme events. And it would have been tremendous if we had more time. We would have looked at 5,000 or 10,000 events, but attributing them was a manual process. It was a painstaking verification process because we had to filter out events that also release flashes of energy, like volcanoes.
How did you do that? How could you verify that this flash of energy you saw was really a fire?
Well, we had a flow diagram, a verification process that we followed. And the way you verify these events is you need independent data streams. And so in the case of is it a fire, the first thing you do is you look at the spectral properties of the energy. And we know that a forest fire will have a particular spectral signature. You then look at other satellite data, particularly area burnt data, and using other satellites indeed. And then you could go, well, at that location around that time or after that time, we can see a fire scar on the landscape. So that gives you a tick. And so you have to go through and be certain that there really was a fire. And then the next thing we did, which fed into this, is we wanted to know off our 500, and we winnowed it down to about 460. We rejected a number of them because they weren't verifiable as forest fires. We then wanted to know whether they were economically or socially destructive. And that was helpful also to verify they were fires, because generally really big fire events get reported in the media, and all of these fire events, if you will, had an address. And so we could search the web for reports in the media, or indeed in government, for fires at a particular time, at a particular location, or near a particular town. And then we were able to, again, verify that it was a fire, and also attribute whether it was destructive to human values.
Of course, there are some terrible fires in Siberia that aren't reported, and nobody has reporters in the Congo where there's civil wars and such, so it's possible that some important events could be left out or not.
Well, certainly in the boreal zone or in remote areas, even in outback Australia, believe it or not, we saw some extreme fires, and there's a reason for those extreme fires. We would be able to verify they were fires, for sure, because our verification process, you can't disguise a fire scar in the boreal, you know, and that particularly hangs around for years. So we would be able to verify they were fires. Whether they killed people or disrupted infrastructure really got down to what was reported in the web and whether it was translatable from maybe Russian into English and interpretable in a way that you could attribute destruction. So we don't claim that we have a comprehensive, and I think in a sense, this is sort of one of the shocking features of our work. We don't claim we have a comprehensive database. Nobody does. That's shocking to me. Something as important as destructive forest fires, there isn't a global database. But we do have a very reliable sample, which enabled us to do what we call pyrogeographic analyses, or the understanding the geography of these fires.
And then you do undertake to discuss which are disasters in human terms and which are possibly natural wildfires, or at least not that damaging to humans per se. So what are the criteria that qualify these fires as a disaster?
The criteria that qualify disaster is economic impact, loss of life, or declaration of an emergency by the government in general terms. So it's something that humans care about. I think there's an important point here, is that not all of these highly energetic fires are disastrous for humans. So there are big fires burning out in the backcountry. Now, they may be ecologically disastrous, and they may be contributing to carbon pollution, and they may be contributing to smoke pollution, which is affecting cities. And we didn't consider that. We just considered the direct impact on people and on people's livelihoods, infrastructure, and so on. So there's two important points here. One is that there are these fires out there that are having an effect, but they're not having a direct effect. But also, these disastrous fires, which we were able, as a subset, had a different geography to the background highly extreme events that we're talking about, this top 500. And they are concentrated generally in two places, the west of the North America, and particularly in the US, and the south of Australia. They're the real core areas, and emerging concern will be the Mediterranean. So there's something about those places, and it turns out it's climate, vegetation, so you've got the right climate, the right vegetation, but most importantly, the right settlement patterns. And the way you get a really good disastrous fire in the main, or to get this concentration of disastrous fires, is you create a combustible inhabited landscape, which is you intermix houses and the bush. And in fact, if you sort of, you know, think of what I'm saying, you know, that's like one way of saying it as a precursor to a disastrous fire. Another way of saying it, that's a really nice place to live. And there's the problem that as people get wealthy, they want to live outside the cities, and they want to live with the amenity value of forests. Forests are, you know, very beautiful, peaceful places. People want privacy and clean air and so on. So they literally build into these forests. You know, we've all seen photographs of this. They're sort of grafting suburban existence into these forested landscapes without really any consideration of the ecology of these landscapes. And then there's, you know, of course, the hullabaloo when the fires come and burn down houses. And unfortunately, we're seeing in the Mediterranean this, I sometimes think of it as a socio-ecological pathology, because it's like all of these natural hazard crises, people building on floodplains when they know it's a floodplain because that's where floods occur. And then you say, oh, well, we'll build a flood barrier, and that makes it even more desirable to live there. So in the fire equivalents, we'll have better and better technology to put fires out. But then eventually the flood barrier breaks, or the fire technology can't cope with fires of such phenomenal intensity, and that's when you get death and destruction. And unfortunately, in the Mediterranean, due to land use changes, the traditional intensive landscapes, which didn't carry extreme fires, have become really quite dramatically overgrown with flammable vegetation. And simultaneously, there's, because of rural drift into the cities, poorer people, rural people, have been attracted to the cities, changing land use and economic policy. And then richer people are saying, well, I want to get out of the city. And so they go and start building back into these landscapes that used to have more traditional agriculture. And before you know it, in a bizarre sort of irony, the Mediterranean is becoming like the Western US and Southern Australia in terms of having a fire management crisis.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is Dr. David Bowman from the University of Tasmania. We're talking about human exposure to extreme wildfire events. Yes, the Mediterranean. Now, science suggests the climate of the Mediterranean will become hotter and drier, more like that of North Africa. I wonder, will that climate change add to the sort of human landscape risk that you've just described?
Well, that's right. We did a very simplistic climate future analysis, and it's simplistic. Projecting fire risk into the future is extremely difficult because it involves not only climate, but also involves the biology, the landscape ecology, and it also involves human ignitions and human settlement patterns. What we did is that we said, well, we know there's a threshold in the fire weather index where you get most above this threshold, you get most extreme fire events. So that was sort of like a benchmark. And then we looked at each cell around globally, and we took some agreed projections, and of course they are projections, they're not predictions of future climate, and then counted up the number of days, the percent increase above that threshold into the future, so the mid of this century. And the alarming news is that it's certainly not going to get any better, but we're seeing between a 20 to 50% increase in the number of days where you could carry an extreme fire. And certainly the Mediterranean, right across the Mediterranean, jumps out as a place where we're going to see a real stepping up of fire risk. And this is, you know, completely consistent with many other studies. You know, there's now actually quite a burgeoning research field in Mediterranean fire ecology, because this is already beginning to play out. They're beginning to see extreme fire events. And, of course, we know about the heat waves in Europe and so on. So, you know, and in fact, that's what we're having right now in this summer in Australia and the mainland. We're seeing heat waves in the central east coast of Australia, particularly around Sydney and up into Brisbane. And one of the things our study suggested is this sort of further expansion of extreme fires up the east coast of Australia. And sure enough, this summer we're seeing quite a lot of significant fire activity to the north of Brisbane. and affecting suburbs and making national news. So again, I would reiterate, you know, we're not in the business of predictions. These are pragmatic estimations of risk, lots of constraints, and there's lots of extra finessing you could do with this, but it basically completely consistent with what everybody is saying, and there's a simple reason for why it's consistent with what everybody's saying, and that is that the precursor, one of the things our study showed, is that the precursor to extreme fire events is anomalous extreme weather events, particularly heat, but also stronger winds, dryness. Those things all converge to create the recipe, if you will, for extreme fire events.
You know, you're reminding me of a conversation I had with the Canadian fire expert Mike Flanagan, and my question to him was that climate scientists were saying the boreal forests, the northern forests of Canada, are going to get wetter and wetter as some areas further south get drier and drier, but we were seeing more forest fires up there. So I asked him, well, how can you have more forest fires if the area is getting wetter? And he said the answer is thin northern soil. It only takes 3 hot days, the kind of weather you've just talked about, for that soil to dry out, and then you can have a fire fairly soon after the rains. So, you know, it seems like it doesn't take a big change in climate to make a big difference for how long the fire season will run or the kind of fires we'll get.
Well, that's right. And an example, actually, of this, what we call antecedent or the preceding conditions, in Australia, in the outback, we can get extreme fires if you have a wet season, like we've had in some parts of the outback this summer. You get a lot of rain, and that makes basically the outback, which is generally arid, like the tropics, because it's really warm and wet, and you get an incredible production of biomass. Now, of course, it during the dry season, it switches back to being very hot and dry, and normally you don't get a lot of fire up there because there's no biomass, because it's a desert, if you will. It's an arid environment, so it's low vegetation productivity. But when you get this extra rainfall, you can get a pulse of fine fuels, and then, you know, if you get a hot, dry season, you can get these spectacularly big fires which will burn across the core of the continent. So that's exactly right. It's a very paradoxical situation that even wet springs in southern Australia, we have the same problem like we've had this last spring, where it's been very wet. You get a lot of production of fine fuels, and then it's really a waiting game, and we're in exactly that place here in Tasmania. It's been a very warm, consistently warm summer, but no heat waves yet. So everything is just sort of on simmer, but there's this huge pool of hot air on the continent, which is actually currently being vented out into Sydney. So, you know, the city of Sydney and Brisbane have been having these, you know, just stupendously historic, you know, unbearable heat, you know, really affecting the headlines and city life. But were that heat to be channeled southward into Tasmania, even this fire season, we could see trouble. And part of the reason for trouble is because we've got so much fine fuel from the wet spring.
I remember seeing those pictures of fires in Tasmania where there was a family huddled around a dock while the whole sky blazed above them. But at that same time, there was a much less reported fire in northern Tasmania, was there not? And it was an important preservation area. Could you tell us about that?
Well, it's actually in the west. So Tasmania is it's an intriguing island that it's basically split on the western side. It's very, very low density. And it's a little bit like a miniature boreal sort of situation. It's got organic soils, some dense forests, some, like, you know, open boggy vegetation, which is, I guess, almost analogous to a tundra. And that vegetation will burn only when it's extremely dry. And what happened is in the last 4 years, in 2013, when there was a very hot extreme fire event, which actually the Dunalley fire event, which the family hiding under the pier, was in our top 500 database. as that happened, there was a giant fire occurring in Western Tasmania under these very severe weather conditions. So that really highlights, I think, a key point that you can have an extreme destructive fire. The city of Dunalley, or the township of Dunalley, was basically destroyed, and people were running for their lives, jumping into the sea. I mean, truly incredible story. But on the other side of the island, where nobody lives, there was just this huge fire. It was, in Tasmanian terms, it was 46,000 hectares, and nobody was fighting it. It just was burning, and it was burning into the peat. And the smoke was coming out of that wilderness into Hobart, polluting the atmosphere. And then what happened last fire season, the 2016 fire season, an extraordinarily dry spring, just a ridiculously dry spring, historically truly off the wall. Lightning storms ignited about 90 fires in the west, and they burnt for 60 days, and they were burning into wilderness areas which have some Gondwanic vegetation, relic vegetation, really weird Gondwanic ancestors to the giant redwood pines and all sorts of curious and odd plants that of which there are fossils in Antarctica. I mean, these are really, you know, some of these things have been unchanged for almost 100 million years. You know, they're very unusual vegetation which can't withstand fire at all. These environments were actually under threat because of the incredibly huge and slow burning, because it was in the peat, in the organic soils, burning fires. But that wouldn't qualify, according to our definition, as an extreme fire. It didn't. Maybe there was a few occasions where it might have been an extreme fire, but most of it was actually slow moving, just under the influence of extreme drought.
Now, in this paper, you make another really important point. We're going to have to wrap up soon, but you say that cities recognize earthquake risk. They make bylaws. We spend a lot of money to reduce earthquake damage and prepare the population, but we don't do the same for fire, and especially with climate disruption coming. What can we do to make our cities more fireproof, or at least help the population escape if they need to?
Well, there's absolutely a huge amount of information about how to make cities more fireproof. I've had the privilege of visiting Vancouver. And again, Vancouver is sort of like, in my mind, a giant version of Hobart. It's a city, particularly the north side of Vancouver, it's a city which is going to get really hammered by an extreme fire event. It's got all of the symptoms of people building into vegetation that can support fire. They have no experience of fire. There's an aversion to clearing around houses because people want amenity value. And even the Canadian government has provided, the British Columbian government have provided funding to clear around communities. There's very limited uptake because there's, in other words, we've got all of the knowledge to make, or not all of, but most of the knowledge we have to make cities and settlements significantly more fireproof. But that requires changing the landscape. And the biggest break on this is actually the appetite in the community for that change, because it's contrary to what most people are living in these places. They don't want to see the forest thinned out. They don't want to see fuel treatment. They don't want to spend the money on making their houses fireproof. They're living in la-la land, really, that we're just, you know, thinking, and same thing in Hobart. We're just sort of winging it. We go, yeah, we know 50 years ago Hobart nearly burnt down, but, you know, we're really going to fight tooth and nail if somebody starts trying to, you know, do interventions which are going to cost money or affect the amenity value of my suburb or my backyard or whatever. So it's basically being put in the too hard basket socially, and my prediction is that the only way we break through this is, and maybe even that is, we have to have an event, another event like the 1967 event in Hobart, to really get this right at the very top of the political agenda. Even the Dunalley fire, there was a government inquiry, there was lots of improvements in fire management and so on, but it's getting it to be stuck onto the community. We know that there's a large, from surveys and inquiries, we know there's a large number of people living in a place like Hobart that just are in denial. They don't believe, they just don't believe the message. They don't want to hear the message. So it's not so much a lack of technology or lack of knowledge. It's actually getting the community engaged. And I think the tragedy with climate change denial is that we've already got a really bad problem, which would be existing even if it wasn't for climate change. But climate change is making a bad problem much worse. But in a sense, the denial aspect of it almost works in the opposite direction of getting adaptation, because people will say, oh, well, you know, it's not really certain that there is climate change. And then once you introduce doubt into all of this conversation, and you already are inclined not to do anything, then it plays to your advantage. You know, you want to hear, you want to hear what you want to hear. And so you go, well, there's no problem, so we'll just keep living dangerously. And people aren't even aware they are living dangerously until you have something like a Fort McMurray event where you go, that just wasn't meant to happen. But translating the anger and the grief from these events into adaptive responses, that's a really big project.
Well, we'll see whether we can do it with climate change. As you say, it's human resistance. And I did a program with a person who said that human denial was just a part of the way our brains evolved, and it's very difficult to get rid of. So I think we're going to have to wrap it up there, David. It's been really fascinating talking with you. We've been discussing the paper, Human Exposure and Sensitivity to Globally Extreme Wildfire Events, and that was published in the journal Nature on February 6, 2017. Our guest is the lead author. I'll put links to this paper and other fire interviews on Radio EcoShock in my show blog at ecoshock.org. That comes out on Wednesdays. David Bowman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, pleasure. Good on you. Thanks.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
In America, the man who swore to dismantle the Environmental Protection Agency has been approved to head it. The last of the EPA staff from Obama days have established a mirror site to preserve the climate change and species information provided formerly by that agency. Meanwhile, in Berkeley, teams of young people have downloaded reams of databases from NASA. They've also set up software to track changes and deletions by the Trump administration. That's it. We are reduced to saving what we can before the new dark age of denial. But we know what time it is on the big clock. Our planet is weaving out into a new form, heading through floods, fires, and storms towards the gate of mass extinction. Our children and descendants are in danger. I will continue to bring you cutting-edge science, activism, and information you need to know. Please pass it on as far and as wide as you can. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock and caring about our world. The last word goes to troubadour David Rovics at davidrovics.com. Let's make the planet Earth great again.
We could take on other issues, like the survival of our race. By which I mean the bipeds on this floating rock in space. The most invasive species anywhere around. The one that keeps on burning everything that can be found. The one that will get it together in the nick of time and then make the planet Earth great again. Stop spending money on antiquated technology, such as tanks and missiles, most other things military. We can use those vast resources to make us all safe and sound. Windmills in the air, coal and oil in the ground. We can be the envy of the rest of the galaxy when we make the planet Earth great again.
Tired of cheerleaders and phony media issues?
We treat climate change almost as if it's something external. It's a sort of problem that we've created that we can solve with human genius. But I don't think it is. I think climate change is our society. Climate change is who we are.
Looking for the awful truth? Dig in with Alex Smith. Top scientists, authors, and activists, the ones you want to hear. No Fear Deep Green Radio Eco Shock. Join us.